So if you're like me, you like to know where we're going when you hear a program like this. The program is essentially divided into three parts. I'm going to speak about the context of where we find ourselves in the world today first, because it's within the context of unprecedented circumstances that the message in ourselves has been discovered. Secondly, we're going to speak about how this code works, precisely how it can be derived and how we translate biology into language. Lastly, we're going to speak about what it means in our lives. What good does this code do us today? Certainly it's interesting, but how do we apply it in our lives and what does it mean? The context within which we find ourselves in the world today lays the foundation for perhaps why this code has been discovered now, maybe not 50 years ago or 25 years ago. We're living a time unlike any other time in recorded human history, and I know that you know that to be true. But have you ever really thought about how much our world has changed in only the last 100 years? In the last 100 years, we've attained powers unprecedented in human history. We can now customize our gene pool. We can access the DNA in our embryos and optimize the DNA for eye color, hair color, muscle conditioning, for athletic performance. Is it right? Is it wrong? Is it good or is it bad? We're still dealing with the implications, the moral implications of what it means to have this technology, and we have the technology available to us today. In the last 100 years, we've attained the power to create new forms of matter. We create stuff in laboratories that's never been seen in this world before. And we can engineer brand new forms of life. And we can replicate that life and duplicate it time and time again. All of these are powers, historically, that have been left to what we call God and nature. Now we have them at our fingertips. We can do these things. Co-founder of the new principle, the new theory in physics, the superstring theory, Dr. Michio Kaku, comments on our time in history and how unique this time really is. What he says is that for most of human history, we could only watch what he calls the beautiful dance of nature. However, today, he says, we're on the cusp of this epic-making transition from being passive observers of nature to being active choreographers of nature. Before his death in 1996, astronomer Carl Sagan identified something very similar. He saw the uniqueness of our time, and he actually coined a term. I love the word that he coined to describe our time in history. Carl Sagan said that we're living a time that he called technological adolescence. Technological adolescence. He said it's a time where we gain access to the fundamental forces of creation on the one hand, and on the other hand, we're still gaining the maturity to know how to use those powers wisely. Well, I think you'll probably agree with me. In many respects, our technology has grown faster than the wisdom of how we apply it in our lives, all the way from medicine to nuclear energy to what we're speaking about here, to the DNA of our bodies and how we use that technology to address life conditions itself. Well, I find a great irony in our time in history. Because while all this amazing technology exists on the one hand, the technology that gives us access, direct access to the forces of nature, on the other hand, we're still witness to war, famine, and hate on unprecedented levels in our world today, conditions that you would think we could change with that kind of technology. In the last 100 years, we've become a species tremendously defined by our differences, differences that we've used to separate us rather than bring us together as a family, differences in our religions, differences in our skin color, differences in our wealth, differences in just the way we believe in our world. Well, technology has given new meaning to these kinds of differences. Between 1900 and 1999, we've all lived the century now that we call the 20th century. And while we may have speculated during that time what that century was all about, now that it's behind us, we no longer have to speculate. Historians have compiled statistics that tell us of the uniqueness of our last 100 years in this world. And while many, many very good things happened in that 100 years, rarely do the good things cause problems. Between 1900 and 1999, more humans lost their lives at the hands of other humans just because they were different than at any other time in recorded human history. When I was researching the book, The God Code, and I came across this information, I had to look at it carefully because it surprised me. Historians now call the 20th century the single most murderous century in all of recorded human history, bar none. Surprised me because I always thought that the time of the Romans was a pretty bloody time, and I knew during the Inquisitions, those were very hard times in our world. But what the historians are saying to us today is that so many people lost their lives just because they were different at the hands of other people. Over five times more lives were taken intentionally in the last 100 years than were lost to all the natural disasters and all the AIDS combined for the same period of time. We've got to look at those numbers. Over 80 million people lost their lives to a condition now that is defined as genocide. The United Nations in 1948 had to identify what this condition, what this practice really meant so they could make it illegal and outlaw it during the 20th century. 80 million people lost their lives because of the differences in the way we see ourselves in our world, in the way we see one another and our relationship to a higher power. Those numbers are staggering, and I've got to ask you the question, why do you think I would even bother to share those numbers now? Why is it important? We're into the 21st century now. We're into the fifth year of the 21st century. Why would those kinds of statistics be important? Well, they're important for one reason. And the reason is, although the century is behind us, the thinking that led to that kind of destruction is continued into the 21st century. Historians are telling us that if the first 4 or 5 years of the 20th century are any measure of what this 100 years will be like, at the end of the 21st century, the statistics of the numbers of our brothers and sisters in this world that lost their lives just because they were different, those numbers in the 20th century will pale in comparison to where we may find ourselves. And it doesn't have to happen that way. And we all know that. It doesn't have to happen. It can change in a heartbeat. And for it to change, something has to change. The way we see ourselves has to change. In January of 1999, just before the millennium, the World Watch Institute released a study. And the study said, a bright promise of our new century is clouded by unprecedented threats to the stability of our world. What do you think the single greatest threat to the survival of our species is? What do you think, personally? I always like to ask this question when I'm in foreign audiences, when I travel throughout Europe, Australia, and in the Eastern countries, because there's so many different perspectives on what people feel are the great threats to the survival of our species. I often get answers that say maybe a rogue meteor impact on the planet, maybe that's the greatest threat to our survival, or the collapse of our environment, or abrupt climate change that we're seeing the indications of right now. And while every one of these is a viable answer and certainly worth our consideration and worth looking into, the single greatest threat to the survival of our species right now, it's us. It's humankind. We're the greatest threat to our own survival, specifically our willingness to solve our differences through war. In December of 2001, this was after 9/11, the historian Samuel P. Huntington released an article, a very telling article. It was entitled The Age of Muslim Wars. What he said was, following the events of 9/11, he looked into the world to see the conditions of what was unfolding. He said that we are very possibly on the brink of what he calls a clash of civilizations. These aren't wars between nations. These are wars between beliefs and the way we live our lives. He said the makings of a possible clash of civilizations are present. Well, if we are at that time, if we are at this powerful crossroads in our civilization, this time that Carl Sagan identified as technological adolescence, if we are at the time where our species is defined by our differences, then what makes this time so unique is the presence of all of these things happening at once. having this amazing technology on the one hand, while on the other hand, we're still defined by our differences, and we're willing to justify the use of this technology to destroy one another based on those differences. For the first time in recorded human history, we can say that the fate of our entire species rests upon the choices of a single generation. A single generation. To the best of our knowledge, this has never happened. Never happened before in our past. We have to ask ourselves the question, however, are we the only civilization to have ever reached this point? What do you think? You think, are we the only civilization in the history of the Earth that's ever reached this place in their development where we had such advanced technology and we were still fighting among ourselves that we threatened to destroy ourselves?